Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in San Pedro, California, earned a BA political science from Duke University, and was a four-year starter for Coach K and Duke basketball. He later earned a law degree from Duke Law School. Drafted by the Dallas Mavericks, he played professionally in Italy and Spain from 1986 to 89. And since 1995, he's been a color commentator and studio analyst for ESPN, a longtime champion for student athletic payment, and the most respected voice in college basketball today. His name, Jay Billis. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Jay Billis, the most respected voice in college basketball today. Jay, welcome. An honor to have you.
Well, it's an honor for me to be with you, Jack. Thank you for having me.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Sure. I grew up in a town called Rolling Hills, California. I was born in San Pedro, California, near the Port of Los Angeles. And my dad and mom both grew up in that town, San Pedro. My father is of Yugoslav descent. He was born in the United States but didn't speak English till he went to school as a youngster. And he really worked his whole life. He never really got to play organized sports like I did, even though he was a really good athlete. But he was a commercial fisherman from his early teens into his early 20s, I believe, and then got into the electronics business and had his own television repair and sales shops. He had two of them. And my mother, went to San Pedro High School. She was, she chose to stay at home and raise four kids. And, they say you can't choose your parents, but I was pretty lucky that, that they chose me. So I had a really nice childhood. Older brother who was a outstanding golfer and great athlete, 7 years older, who was my idol, growing up and still is. And, two younger sisters, both of whom are lawyers. And my youngest sister is, the best at everything in our family, best athlete, best lawyer, smartest. So I probably get the most attention because of television, but she's by far the most accomplished.
All right. You were pretty accomplished. You were a consensus top 50 recruit coming out of high school. You averaged 24 points, 13.5 rebounds. A lot of schools were after you. And you go across the country to this school named Duke University. And the previous 2 years, Jay, 80-81, they were 17-13. 81-82, they were 10-17. Why did you go to Duke?
Well, the simple answer, Jack, is Coach K. When he first called me, I think Duke had seen me play in an all-star event during the summertime in Utah. And I started getting phone calls from Duke. And honestly, I didn't know where Duke was. I knew it was on the East Coast. I knew they were in the ACC, but I didn't know it was in the state of North Carolina or Durham or Chapel Hill. I didn't know where any of those things were growing up in Los Angeles. This was pre-internet. We did have maps available, but I wasn't looking at those with regard to where schools were located. And so Coach K, among the coaches I came down to, he was the least well known, and the truth is I didn't know his name when he first called. I had never heard of him, and I'm sure he had never heard of me before that tournament in Utah. But I liked him the best. He was the coach I trusted the most. It wasn't that I didn't trust the others and I didn't love the others, because I think I would have loved playing for a number of different coaches. But I just knew, and it had nothing to do with Duke. It had nothing to do with the ACC versus the Big Ten or the Big East or the Big Eight at the time, where the other schools I was looking at. It really came down to I liked him and I wanted to play for him. And it turned out it was a really good decision, although at the time I just didn't realize how profound of a decision it would be on my life, because saying yes to Coach K changed my life, and it changed the trajectory of it. And honestly, Jack, I don't say this flippantly. I honestly don't know where I'd be right now if it weren't for Coach Day. I have no idea. I mean, I don't think I'd be, you know, selling pencils on the street and destitute, but my life's path would have been significantly different.
For the last 30 years, arguably, he was the modern John Wooden. What made him so unique and successful?
You know, I get asked that question quite a bit, and I don't know how to put it into words, but I'll try. On the basketball side, he's as good as there's ever been. He's intensely competitive, and he's got a wonderful feel for the game and feel for people and how to put combinations together and how to reach people on a human level. So it's less about X's and O's and more about how he grabs your heart. And I don't consider him, you know, a motivator. I think he finds a way to inspire. But I think one of the separators for me with Coach K was how invested he was in me off the court. I would not have gone to law school if it weren't for Coach K. I would not have gotten into coaching if it weren't for Coach K. He greased the skids for me to get into broadcasting. You know, when I was in high school and became a recognized player, you know, you get interviewed and, you know, newspapers do articles on you, things like that. And the question you got back then, or at least I got, was, what do you want to do after basketball? And the truth is, at 17 years old, I didn't know. And at that time, this is back in the early 1980s, late 70s, there were some former athletes that were getting into broadcasting, whether it was Frank Gifford or Don Drysdale or the like, Don Meredith. And so I thought, well, maybe broadcasting. And so I said that in some of these interviews, and Coach K read it. All the coaches did. And he said, how do we make this happen? And he introduced me to a guy named Chuck Howard, who was a senior executive at ABC Sports. And I started working for ABC during the summer. And I did it every summer while I was in college. And if were it not for that, I don't think I would have established relationships in the business. And I don't think I would have gotten into it, honestly. Maybe, but I doubt it. And he was very in tune with, this is what this player wants to do. I was more than just a uniform to him, and all of his players were and are. And it was it's been a lifelong relationship that that never stopped after I stopped playing at Duke. And that's, I'm not sure I could say that's unique, because he's not the only one that does that. But and then I had the benefit, frankly, of the fact that he stayed there for 40 years. And so my relationship with the university, with all my former teammates and guys that played after us, has been significantly different than it would have been had he chosen to go to the NBA or leave for another job somewhere.
We're talking to Jay Billis. Went to Duke, 15 miles down the road was his school, University of North Carolina, and they would have pickup games. And there was a guy on that team by the name of Michael Jordan. When we come back, we're going to talk about pickup games against Michael. And I'm Jack Fasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Fasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Jay Billis, affectionately known as the Billustrator. Jay, you had pickup games regularly against University of North Carolina. So it was Coach K against Dean Smith. And they had phenomenal players. One of them was this man or kid named Michael Jordan. How good was he?
We knew right away. So Jordan was a sophomore when we got to Duke. And those pickup games, we would play, it was preseason, so we would play one, you know, a week. We would go to Chapel Hill, and maybe the next week they'd come to Durham, and, you know, we'd share the travel burden, if you wanted to call it that. So it was player-driven. The coaches weren't involved in it. Some of the players knew one another, and we all got to know one another through those games. And the first time we played, we hadn't even played a college game, and went over to Chapel Hill, and that was the first time I saw him in person. I had watched him play in the NCAA tournament the year before, but didn't really know much about him. I obviously hit the shot to beat Georgetown in the championship game in 1982, But it's not like I knew his game or knew his reputation beyond that tournament. You know, this is pre-internet, so, you know, you didn't know as much about national players as you do now. And from the first pickup game, we knew this guy's different. Like, I don't know how to couch it, Jack, but I remember, like, reading when I was a kid about Mickey Mantle, and other players would say the ball made a different sound when it came off of Mantle's bat. Just this thing that players know, and you knew playing against Jordan, watching him, like, nobody else can do this. And or if somebody else can, it's a very small class. So when people ask now, did you guys know Jordan was going to be great? The answer is yes. Now, at teenage years, could I have processed that we're playing against the someone who's going to be considered the greatest player of all time? We probably didn't take it to that level, but you know, we knew he's going to be an NBA All-Star perennially and Hall of Famer. There was just the athleticism, the competitive nature. You know, when he left the floor and you left the floor, I don't know that the law of physics is suspended for any player, but if it ever was, like, you know, I think his hang time was just because he jumped higher and it took him longer to come down. But it was absurd, the things that he could do in the air, and we knew right away.
Speaking of championships games, let's move ahead to April 1986, Dallas, Texas. You're in the championship, your senior year, Duke against Louisville. You had 37 wins, still the NCAA record for most wins in a single season. Talk about that championship game.
You know, it's probably, Jack, the most affecting and frustrating loss of my lifetime in anything. And, you know, when you're that close to winning and you believe, and, you know, honestly, not to take anything away from Louisville because they were great, but we still think we were the better team. And we shot the ball so poorly, you know, open shots that we would normally make. And I think Louisville shot over 50%, and we shot in the 30s, and we lost by a bucket. And had we won that game, I think not only would we have won a championship, which is all we cared about, but, you know, we were being talked about that weekend of the Final Four as where did that team fit in among the greatest teams of all time. And, you know, you don't win that game and all that discussion goes away. And to be that close and lose, you know, we had lost in the NCAA tournament the 2 years before, but we weren't the best team. And so for some reason, those losses don't stick out. Every loss is painful. But that one, when it's right on your fingertips and you don't close it out, you know, that's why every year when I cover the Final Four, my eyes tend to go toward the losing team at the end because I know the feeling. And as a player, I don't know if Coach K or Tom Izzo would agree with this. They've been there so many times. But when you it's different for a player and a coach. When you lose as a coach, you have more opportunities. When you lose as a player, that was our last opportunity. You have so few opportunities that I think it sticks with you longer and in a deeper way. So to be that close, but at the same time, I wouldn't trade that experience we had for anything. You know, the guys I played with are my best friends, and I don't think I've been with any group of people, colleagues, classmates, teammates in other sports that I've developed that kind of bond with. And sports is unique in that way. There may be, look, I can't compare it to, I've never served in the military or anything like that. But I'm as close with those guys and the staff as any group of people I've ever been around. And I'm very grateful for that.
We're talking to Jay Billis, 1986 NBA draft. He went in the fifth round, the 108th person overall to the Dallas Mavericks, and then played in Italy and Spain. Let's move forward to 1989, and Coach K says, come be an assistant coach with me. You were with him for 4 years, okay? You guys won. You went to 3 championships games, and you won 2. I think you made the man.
Yeah, the program really went in the toilet after I left after 3 years. You know, it was interesting, Jack. Like, that was a time in my life where, you know, you mentioned I've been drafted. Yeah, I was one of those guys. I was considered a great high school player. I was a good college player. I was a good role player. And you know, you got drafted back when there were a million rounds in the NBA draft. But I did very well in training camp with the Dallas Mavericks. And you know, I felt like, you know, I'm good enough to make the NBA. But the truth is, you know, that my level was in Europe. And I had two really good years in Italy, and then went to Spain. And my last year in Spain, my third year, wasn't the best year because of the team I was playing on. But I wanted to keep playing because I was really enjoying, honestly, being a star player again. And I thought I would play 10 or 12 years over there and make a bunch of money and then move on to the next phase of my life. But Coach K called me. I had applied to Duke Law School at the urging of my father because my dad thought, if you're going to go to law school, you need to be ready to go at any time if you get injured or what, you know, circumstances change in your basketball life. And if you wait until after you finish playing when you're in your 30s, you're not going to go. And he was right. So I had applied to Duke Law School, and I think Coach K found out about it. And he had called me over the summer and said, if you get admitted to law school, will you go? And I told him that if I get in, I was thinking about deferring and continuing to play because I really wanted to play. And he said, well, listen, here's what I want to do. I want to hire you as an assistant coach, and you go to law school at the same time. You'd be a graduate assistant, and I want you on my staff. And I, you know, I don't know this. I've never really asked him, but I think he was, you know, sort of greasing the skids for me to get into law school. And so he hired me on his staff so that it would be an easier sell to the university to admit me into law school. I don't know that as a fact, but I really believe that that's what happened. So I took it. I thought, this is a good opportunity. So I took it, thought I want to go into coaching, and it was a wonderful basketball education for me to be on his staff. And I got a lot of credit for juggling two things at once, but it really wasn't that hard after the first year. And I really enjoyed it. I mean, it was just it was an honor and a pleasure, and just a learning experience on both sides of the coin with law school and with coaching. So I couldn't have asked for a better situation. And the reason was Coach K had the vision to do that. That was not me. That was him saying, here's the best thing for you, and this is something you want to do, and here's how I can make it happen. And so I give all the credit to him for that. That was all him.
We're talking to Jay Billis, 1995, this fledgling sports company named ESPN hires him to do college basketball. When we come back, we're going to talk about that chapter in his life. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula. We're with Jay Billis, and since 1995... he's been a color commentator, studio analyst for ESPN College Basketball. Jay, describe for us the size of the team, the technology, the production of an ESPN collegiate basketball game in 1995 versus what it is today.
Much bigger in 1995 because of the resource level. You know, in 1995, you had a truck at every game and a full staff at every game. Now, because of technology, you know, some of these buildings are already hardwired. They have their own studio presence, their own control rooms. So the games look a little bit different, except on the biggest games, which I'm lucky to be involved in. So they were bigger operations back then. And you know, every game that you went to was, and still is, but not to the same level, was a huge event. And so for me, getting a start in that, I started in radio in 1993 and then got hired by ESPN in 95. It was, you know, that sort of innocent climb in the business was perhaps the most fun you could ever have. You know, once you've been in it, I've been in it for 27, 28 years now, 30 overall from when I started in radio. Everything, when it was new, you can't describe the level of excitement for it. And I have to remind myself now not to take for granted how exciting it still is. you know, walking into these arenas and working with the people I'm you know, privileged to work with. But when you do it for so long, sometimes you can, you know, you can think it's a routine deal, and it's not. There are people who would kill to be in the positions that so many of us are in now, that I have to remind myself, hey man, don't take this for granted, because you would have committed felonies to get this opportunity 30 years ago. And it's true, I probably would have.
For 30 years, you've worked with, around, a bald guy, blind in one eye, screaming awesome baby, diaper dandy, trifecta, Dick Vitale. What makes him so unique?
Probably the authenticity of Dick. He's a wonderful person, and he loves every part of being in the business and the game and those who are in the game. And I think that shines through. He's a different personality, and I mean that in a positive way. There's nothing fake about Dick Vitale. He's just he's fun to be around, and he's funny and has a great wit. But he wears his emotions on his sleeve, and not everybody does that, and not everybody should. You have to be your own person. But he's authentic, and he's definitely an American original. And I'm lucky in so many ways. One, that he called my games when I was a player, and he's been the soundtrack for those of a certain age to all of our careers. But then I got to work with him, and I get to call him a friend. So that's been an extraordinary blessing.
Jerry Lewis, for I don't know 30 years, had the annual telethon, you know, for muscular dystrophy. And since Jimmy V died, Dick Vitale has been on a mission for the Jimmy V Foundation, etc. Talk about what Dickie V has done for the Jimmy Cancer and the Jimmy V Foundation.
Well, he's thrown his energy, his considerable energy, into that. And he's a hard man to say no to. He's got tremendous energy for the cause, and I think that shows through in everything that he does. But he's been instrumental in raising so much money and increasing awareness and I think getting people to feel what the fight against cancer really is. I think anyone who's been involved in it, whether personally or with a family member or friend, they can feel it. But for those who have been fortunate enough not to be so viscerally affected by cancer yet, because everybody will be, I believe, at some point, hopefully not in the future after we make more gains. We've made incredible gains to this point. But Dick makes people feel it. And when they feel it, they want to get more involved. And so he deserves a tremendous amount of credit for all he's accomplished in that area.
Many people say you were the driving force that pushed the collegiate athletes to fight for the transfer portal rights and NIL. Jay, explain the transfer portal to us.
The transfer portal is just a mechanism that the NCAA devised where players, for years, players, when they transferred, one, they had to sit out a year in five sports, and it was only five. It was football, men's and women's basketball, hockey, and baseball. All of the sports you could transfer and be eligible right away. But in the money sports, a lot of coaches and administrators complained about tampering, that somehow a player had a landing spot before the coaches or administrators ever found out they even wanted to transfer. And so the deal was done before they knew about it. So they came up with this transfer portal. It is not ideal. I think it needs to be better regulated, and timing needs to be improved on decisions. Overall, the concept is laudable, that that you give players an opportunity to move when they choose, because you know the NCAA has drawn a line, says they're not employees, they're students to be treated like any other student. And when the NCAA was fighting in court over money and compensation issues against athletes, they knew that the transfer restrictions and the transfer rules were making them look bad, so they made the change. It's extraordinarily difficult on coaches for roster management and retention of players. That's been frustrating, I know, It's just one of those things that the NCAA is, as you know, Jack, in the middle here. There's transformation going on that they don't want with regard to player compensation, and they're still trying to draw a line in the sand. Now they're drawing it instead of compensation, because we've got, you know, name, image, and likeness rights now for players, which is just a small part of what they're worth in the marketplace. They're drawing the line saying they can't be employees, so they still have to be allowed to transfer. And I know coaches don't like, a lot of coaches don't like, well, they should have to sit out a year. There should be some kind of restriction so that you don't have players leaving for a poor reason or just any reason they pull out of the sky. I'm not sure that's good policy, the way the coaches want it, because that strikes me as like a non-compete provision in an employment contract, and the NCAA says they're not employees. But I think we'll find an equilibrium at some point in the near future, and I think it's going to come through unless Congress steps in to provide some sort of federal law to preempt all the state laws in the NIL area. I think, Jack, in the future, the way this is going to be resolved, absent Congress stepping in, is schools are just going to sign players to contracts. And so they'll make an offer to a player. The player either accepts the offer or not. They negotiate it at arm's length. And schools can have a buyout provision in the contract. So if a player leaves before the end of the term of the contract, that player will owe a buyout number. There are so many ways where parties protect themselves and contracts can be negotiated. And that's where I think we'll wind up.
We're talking to Jay Billis, affectionately known as the Billistrator. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
Jack Crisula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Jay Billis, the most respected voice in college basketball today. Jay, let's talk about collegiate basketball coaches and about all the good that these high school and college coaches do for America's greatest natural resource, our young people.
You know, Jack, the most influential people in my life have been coaches. And it's not that my teachers or professors have not been influential, because they have been, but the most influential have been coaches. And I think most of the best coaches out there on every level understand down to their socks that what they say to their players day to day has tremendous impact. I remember everything my coaches said to me, positive and negative. And no one was more responsible for my confidence, both in raising it and lowering it, than my coaches were. And it's a tremendous responsibility. And while we tend to evaluate coaches on wins and losses, which in some instances is appropriate, really the greatest impact the coaches have is on the lives of their players off the court and off the field of play. And I think one of the measures, and I'm sure Coach K, Tom Izzo, you know, all these great coaches would agree with this, that one of the measures, I think, of your success as a coach is, are you invited to your players' weddings, and do you get announcements when their kids are born and things like that? Are you part of their lives? And you know, to me, that's the good stuff, are the relationships, and it's a relationship business. And I think the very best coaches realize that. Coaching is a noble profession. I really believe that. We don't always treat it that way in our commentary because we get in the weeds of how many championships did this coach win. But I remember Coach K saying something to me back when I was an assistant. We were evaluating a team that we had coming up, and he talked about how good this coach was. The team was, you know, the coach had a 500 record. And he said some of the best coaches that have ever coached this game have 500 records. They haven't had access to the same kind of players. And that really made an impact on me.
All right. We met one night at the DAC, and there was a coach by the name of Tom Izzo who once said to me that a college coach is as much a teacher as most professors. What makes Tom Izzo so special?
Boy, that's a great question. And Tom, I've said this so many times because I believe it. Tom Izzo is one of the best coaches in the history of American sport, not just in basketball. He's not only a winner and a disciplined leader, he has an amazing heart. And that comes through in everything he does. It's not just that he wears his heart on his sleeve and you know what his emotions are and how unfailingly honest he is in every situation. Tom really does have the best interests of the players at heart. He's willing to challenge them when they need it. He catches them doing something right. You know, he praises them when it's required. But I just don't know very many people, let alone coaches, that have their heart in as good a place as Tom does. There's never been a word he has spoken to me that I don't believe. And that doesn't mean we agree on everything. We can differ on an issue or a policy matter, things like that. But I've never ended a conversation with him, whether on the phone or in person, where I didn't go, you know, whether we agree or disagree, that's one of the people I love and respect most in the world. And I think anybody that's ever met him feels the same way. He has the same amount of time for the custodian as he does for the president of the United States. And that's uncommon. And he's got uncommon common sense and just as good a person as I've ever known. And that's one of the reasons he's one of the best coaches of all time.
The person that made this show possible and happen is uncommon as well. Coach Greg Campy. Talk about Campy.
You know, Greg is, he's been at Oakland for, what, 40 years now? And you talk about a guy who loyalty is paramount. Like, Greg could have gone to other places and been more well-known. His ability level as a coach would match anyone that's a household name. But, you know, he has similar impact on his players. And you talk about somebody who's in it for the right reasons, at least what I consider to be the right reasons. None of us have cornered the market on knowing what's right. But he's a coach and a person to be admired. And I'm so grateful that I've gotten to know Greg. And he's just one of the great people in the game. And that's an example of what I had mentioned before, Jack, about, you know, I don't know what Greg's record is. I know he's been extraordinarily successful and always will be because he knows how to do this. But he's not in it for records. He's in it for people. And you know, the one thing I know, you know, Tom Izzo doesn't love his players and his people more than Greg Campy loves his. And that's where those two, they're more equal than people would think. Based upon, you know, when you look in a record book or you know, you're listing the names of the great coaches, you know, whose name rolls off your tongue first. You talk about the great leaders and people whose heart is you cannot doubt. You know, his heart is Mount Rushmore quality.
His record is 675 and 525, a 563 mark for 39 years. Okay, we have another mutual friend who says, Jack, Jay is the best. His name is Tim McCormick, and I quote him now, the greatest challenge in sports is to manage prosperity. Your thoughts on that?
Boy, that's true in anything. I think any time you feel you have something knocked, you're probably making a mistake. And I think, you know, I'm 59 years old now, and for me, you know, I go to work every day and try to treat it like my first day at work. And, you know, Tim McCormick is a fabulous guy. I met him when he was playing for the Rockets back in the mid-'80s, mid to late 80s. And you talk about a guy, you know, he's an extraordinary extraordinarily accomplished basketball man, but you would never know who he was if you didn't already know who he was, because he's got a humility about him that's really refreshing. But he's more than right here that, you know, I think people tend to have a sense of urgency when things aren't going well. Having that same sense of urgency to, you know, pay attention to detail when things are going well, you know, sort of the prosperity idea, that can be a separator. And it's sort of the idea of living in the moment, of being present. And to me, that's what my dad used to talk about, is concentrate on what you're doing while you're doing it. That what happened yesterday doesn't matter. You know, what's going to happen tomorrow, you prepare for, but you don't need to worry about. That can be a challenge for a lot of people, including me. You know, being where your feet are. And I think that's sort of the idea of prosperity. You don't want to, nobody's saying don't celebrate accomplishments. You want to celebrate them. But once you have your celebration, move on and move on to the next thing.
Anybody that knows you, Jay, is impressed with your humility and your gratefulness. Talk about those two things.
You know, I have a friend. I had a friend named Skip Prosser, and Skip died 13 years ago, give or take. And when he passed, he used to say something all the time. And he used to say, "Never delay gratitude." And I think about that all the time. That you know, none of us are entitled to anything. And you know, if you've reached a level that you feel satisfied or whatever, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with feeling satisfied. It's not a question of achieving or all that. But I every day I wake up, you know, I look at my wife, and the first thing I think of is how grateful I am to have her in my life. And, you know, whether I have a job or not, I'll always have her. And that's all I've ever wanted and all I ever need. So I think a lot about gratitude, for all the people who have done for me and sacrificed for me and helped me. And actually, Jack, that's the one thing that drives me. To the extent I can help somebody else, I feel that's an obligation, because so many people helped me, and I can't repay that. The only way I can repay it, if you will, is to what they call pay it forward, is to do my best to help somebody else like people have helped me.
Jay, everybody that meets you is grateful to have met you. Thanks for all you do. Keep up the great, great work.
Thank you so much.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Prasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.
Believe in yourself.